I grew up in Northfield in southern Minnesota, and Joe and his family, my two uncles and my mother and two aunts, grew up in St. Paul. And in the late 1920s, their mother died. Joe was seven, and the three youngest children were made wards of the state of Minnesota and committed to the Owatonna Orphanage. And that's really where Joe's story begins.
Now, tell us about this, the process, or what the Owatonna Orphanage was like, and what people, what happened to orphans in those days?
Well, it was a really sad story, and there's a wonderful museum in Owatonna today dedicated to the memory of the 10,600 young orphans that passed through the gates of Owatonna. It was established in the post-Civil War era. People might remember reading about the orphan trains that brought orphans out to the Midwest, primarily to put young boys to work on farms. In Minnesota, it was well-intentioned, I think. The legislature established the orphanage in 1886 as sort of a holding place until they could be transferred to local farmers. And from 1886 to 1945, there were 10,600 that passed through the gates of Owatonna. And sadly, 200 are there today, buried only with a number to initially mark their grave until a local orphan by the name of Harvey Wronglian and his wife Maxine were able to rally the local community and put names on the graves and establish this remarkable museum that is there today.
You mentioned it came out of the Civil War. Was this because there were so many widows or orphan children as a result of the Civil War?
Yeah, absolutely. There were 600,000 killed during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And, of course, this being Memorial Day, that's a significant reminder because Memorial Day began as a result of the Civil War. And our first Memorial Day services were shortly after the Civil War, and there were literally hundreds of thousands of young orphans. And Minnesota was, you know, attempting to do a sort of the Minnesota Nice version of in the 1800s, but it unfortunately adoption was stigmatized, and so it wasn't an option. And Minnesota passed its indenture law, which gave the authority to the state to sign contracts with local farmers and other families to indenture the children. Boys outnumbered girls about 3-1 at the Owatonna Orphanage, and typically there would be 300 to 500 there at any one time. It was totally self-sufficient, 350 acres, like a city within a city, and they lived in two-story sort of military-style barracks. There were a total of 16 of these cottages, they called them, 12 for boys and 4 for girls. And the girls tended to fare better. They were indentured to local families. In the case of my mother, for example, she was indentured to the Reverend Pinkham at the St. James School for Boys in Faribault, and they later became history professors at Carleton College, and they placed a great value on education and insisted that my mother not only go through high school but on to college and get her teaching certificate, which she did. But she and Joe were separated, and the orphanage wouldn't even tell her where he was when he was indentured to this brutal German immigrant farm family for 8 years. And finally, she forced the Owatonna Orphanage to reveal his whereabouts, and she was able to bring him books. The farm family that he was indentured to refused to let him go to school. He had no one to talk to, no one to play with. And she told him to try to learn to read and write. She brought him a copy of the Declaration of Independence and read to him that all men are created equal, and said, copy the signature of John Hancock. It's the biggest one, and it's got your initials. And he did. And she said, keep writing down questions. And he would ask questions. And what's remarkable about the book is that it's based on Joe's journal. That includes his essays, his poems, his songs, his other writings, and the fact that his journal, going back to the 1930s, and the journal that he kept during the war, and later as a steelworker on America's skyline, until he died in the 1990s. The remarkable thing is that journal survived, and that forms the basis for the book.
Is that what do you think sustained him? Was it the books or the contact with the family or his questions or his journal?
Yeah, I think what sustained him when you read his writings is that One, he was exceptionally bright, and he was deep down a scientist. He was untrained because he had no opportunity to go to school, but what scientists do is observe. And what Joe had to observe on the farm was nature. There was a creek that ran around the edge of the farm, and every spare moment he would have, so they had to work 7 days a week from sunrise to sunset, but when there were spare moments or when it rained, he would be at the creek, and he taught himself to hunt and fish and to trap and to snare birds and rabbits and squirrels, and he would skin them and tan their hides and smoke their meat to supplement his meager diet. And he drew hundreds and hundreds of pictures throughout his entire life. And later, after the war, he became a very talented professional taxidermist at night and on weekends. And he studied anatomy and geology and paleontology and history. He became an expert on many subjects, and you see that reflected in his poems and in his essays. He said that the period between the orphanage and when World War II broke out right after Pearl Harbor, when he enlisted, was like one long boot camp that prepared him for Christmas night, 1944, during the Battle of the Bulge, when he was recommended for the Silver Star for gallantry and won 3 Bronze Stars for valor, and then later the Purple Heart fighting hand-to-hand against fanatical young Germans. So I think what sustained him, Kathy, was his ability to think and to think deeply about life. His questions that he began writing in his journal on the farm were questions about life, about the meaning of life, about why does God treat children so horribly? Why does God treat our animals so horribly? And he would ask these penetrating questions, and you see them time and time again, repeated throughout his journal. He loved to, what he discovered when he finally escaped from the farm, he was only 17 and weighed less than 100 pounds. It was 1936, the depths of the Great Depression. There were over 50% unemployment in southern Minnesota where he was. And he and the farmer got into their last scuffle, and the farmer would always hit him on his left ear, and it would bleed and ring loudly with pain, and Joe picked up a 2x4 and hit the farmer with it and stunned him, and he ran into the barn where he slept and picked up his gunny sack with his few belongings and ran 10 miles to the nearest railroad junction and hopped on the first train out of the state. And for 4 years, he rode freight trains across the country, but what he discovered in the process were free public libraries, friendly librarians who would always point out good things to read but who would often share a sandwich with him, who would often point him to an odd job. And that, he said, those 4 years were like his high school and college all packed into one. And they also told him about President Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps, a conservation program that enlisted 3.5 million young men like Joe during the 1930s. And Joe was assigned to Isabella, Minnesota, up on the Canadian border in what is today the Superior National Forest. He was there for 18 months, just until the war broke out. So I think that's what sustained him, and you see it throughout all of his writings.
Now, how did you find out all of this? How did you discover his life?
He's my uncle, and as I mentioned earlier, growing up in Northfield, he made a big impression on me. And Joe and I stayed in contact throughout his life. He died in 1992. I'll never forget, I'm old enough to remember World War II. Almost like it was yesterday. And I'll never forget in the spring of 1945, it was April, just before President Roosevelt died, and 3 big boxes with my name on them arrived at the post office, and they were German war souvenirs, German bayonets and swastikas and flags and German money and German medals and helmets, and I was the hero of my third grade class. And then 2 years ago, 3 more boxes arrived of Joe's things from my cousin, Joe's son. And they included his poems and his essays and his songs and his military records and his medals and his collection of little blue books, which was how he educated himself when he escaped from the farm and also during the war. These were little books that sold for a nickel at every drugstore in the country in the 20s and 30s, and they published virtually all of the classics going back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, as well as high school and college subjects. So that's how it got going. And when I looked into the boxes that my cousin James sent me, I realized I had to tell Joe's story to the world. I had written three books prior to this on the radical militant Islam and the ideology of Al-Qaeda, and I was working on a third when this happened, and I'm hoping to publish this third book soon. But Joe's journals sidetracked me, and so for the last 2 years, I wrote the book, and we launched the book tour last fall at the Owatonna Orphanage, and then down to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. Both Garrison Keillor and Dr. Nick Mueller, who's the World War II advisor to Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, they both wrote very nice endorsements on the back cover of the book. And as a matter of fact, they even got the book into the hands of Hanks and Spielberg, and there's hope that it might become a movie.
We're speaking with Wayne Quist. He's the author of God's Angry Man, The Incredible Journey of Private Joe Hahn. Private Joe Hahn was Wayne's uncle, and you've heard a lot of that story through Wayne this morning. But Wayne, was your uncle's experience as a boy on this farm, the brutality that he experienced and the slave labor, was he just unlucky, or was that common for many of the orphaned boys?
It was common for many, and if you go to the museum, you will see the very sad, sad stories that happened to many of the kids coming out of the orphanage. But it truly was the luck of the draw, and as I gave you in the example of my mother, she was indentured to a wonderful family, and my aunt, in the same case, to a Catholic family in St. Paul. But I think the boys tended to fare a little better. I think the stigma of being an orphan was really difficult to overcome. It's well documented that they were referred to as bad orphans, as misfits, as outcasts. This is in the writing that you see of the era. But it's really a tremendous thing what Harvey Rongelian did in establishing this museum. And they've saved the old building. It now houses the mayor's office and the city council and the Owatonna Art Center, in addition to the museum there. And it tells the story.
How would you describe the poems and songs he wrote?
They come from his heart. They express his deepest feelings. And I think the book probably expresses mine. When I do book presentations, as I've done around the country, I read a lot of the poems. I was just in Austin, Minnesota at the Hormel house last week, and I was also, I give a lot of talks to Rotary groups and other civic groups. I was at the Minnesota History Center on Pearl Harbor Day. I think some of the most dramatic writings come out of the war because of the wrenching experience. And he was with one of the toughest units, Patton's Third Army, during the Battle of the Bulge. There were over 80,000 American casualties during the Battle of the Bulge. This was December 1944. And just before that, Joe was trapped in the same foxhole with a dead German soldier for 3 days, and he writes this moving poem, an essay called Memories of Death. And I'll just read you a couple of stanzas. He says, a dead man speaks, for the violence that flares about me is shocking and sometimes stifling. I'm carried in a high wind like the down of a flower into a fray of which I have no interest. For all of my energies, physical and mental, are concerned with other pursuits. Distant galaxies, infinity and time, space and matter, the velocity of light, the significance of a one-celled creature, does an amoeba think? These thoughts transcend all other events of the moment while I attempt to keep my poor body dry, sitting on the corpse of a dead man, the enemy. His poems cast this type of mood that's based on observation and deep feeling. He started calling himself God's Angry Man at the orphanage after every beating. Miss Morgan, who was the matron of his unit, his so-called cottage, carried with her at all times a radiator brush as long as a baseball bat, and when she didn't have that, it was a rubber hose. And this is how the boys were beaten, and after each beating, under his breath, Joe began muttering, "God's angry man." The same at the orphanage when he would be beaten by the farmer in the woodshed.
Did Joe eventually believe in God, or what did this do to his spiritual
life? I think Joe's reflection on life was created through this really difficult period that he had, that he defines as the 15 years of boot camp that prepared him for the war. And then came the war. And then after the war, for 33 years, he had probably one of the toughest jobs in America. In 1946, he went down to Oklahoma, and he married Helen Jesse, a member of the Choctaw Nation. He had met her when he was in training there before he went to Europe. And her relatives and brothers told Joe how Native Americans had built the skyscrapers in New York City, and how they built the steel bridges and the steel skyscrapers that he had seen in California. And he headed south to Houston and joined the local 84 Iron Workers Union. And for 33 years, he worked on high steel. And on his last day on the job, he wrote what is one of the most moving poems ever written, dedicated to his fellow steel workers, called High Steel. It's been published 3 times in the Iron Workers magazine, and this year I'll be invited to speak at the National Convention and also at the AFL-CIO Convention to read Joe's poem, High Steel. I think if there's anything that defines Joe's religion, it's one that transcends the hatred that is caused by religious theology, where man kills man, like we're seeing happen in the Middle East today, for example, Muslim killing Muslim. And we saw what happened with the Christian religion during the Reformation when, you know, from 1618 to 1648, half the German population was killed, Catholic fighting Protestant, and the same in Ireland and elsewhere. And this is what Joe rejected, and he spoke in many ways like an Old Testament prophet, and in many ways his life was like the story of Joseph out of the Old Testament, sold into slavery, but with this indomitable will to overcome adversity. So he transcended religion, and I think his religion was more similar to the religion of the deists of the 18th century French Enlightenment.
Wayne Quist, his book is called God's Angry Man, The Incredible Journey of Private Joe Hahn. Joe Hahn was Wayne's uncle, and it is an incredible story, Wayne. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.